Welcome to our middle of the afternoon session. We had two oral arguments earlier, and glad that everyone was able to accommodate the switch out. We'll just get started if everyone's ready. I'll ask Bonnie to call the case. And Brett Kudnick?
Yes,
John. Okay, just trying to figure out who everyone is. All right, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I do want to begin by thanking the court and counsel for accommodating my request to change the time of the arguments so that I might attend the funeral of Mary's child. I appreciate that very much. Well, you know, 3 to 5 issues, that's sort of the wisdom in appellate law. We tried very hard in this case to limit the issues, but there were numerous errors committed by the trial court. We identified 13 that we believe to be harmful. And, of course, I can't possibly address all of the issues that we've raised, but and I suspect the court perhaps would not want me to try to do that today. So I've decided to limit my argument to two law issues of statewide importance that challenge the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the jury's findings in questions 2 and 5 that Crosstex negligently created a nuisance that caused a reduction in the market value of the Gardner's property. To help you visualize, if you will, the lay of the land where the alleged incident has taken place, we've supplied photographs and aerials that were introduced into evidence at trial in our appendix in the reply brief. I realize they're not very good images, but I hope that they give you some idea of the landscape surrounding the compressor station from different viewpoints, including the Gardner's 95-acre track. The station itself is very similar to one just north of downtown here near the Oakhurst neighborhood on I-35. Now, there are two key facts about the condition of the Gardner's property that are undisputed and that we believe are critical to a correct disposition of this case. First, at the time the compressor station was constructed by Crosstex in May of 2007. At the time it went into operation, the Gardner's property was undeveloped pasture that they were using exclusively for agricultural purposes, such as grazing cattle, keeping and riding horses, and so forth. The second undisputed fact is that while the Gardners contend that they also kept the property for investment purposes, it's undisputed that they had no plans to develop the property in the near future, nor had they taken any action of any kind to prepare the property for development before the compressor station was installed. But notwithstanding these undisputed facts, the Gardner's land appraisal expert opined that the highest and best use of the pasture prior to the construction and operation of the compressor station was for residential development, not its current agricultural use. And based on this opinion, the jury found in question 5 that the market value of the Gardner's property had been reduced by over $2 million, which we contend resulted in a windfall to the Gardner's because both experts agreed that the compressor station would have caused no diminution in the value of the property if the property was valued based on its existing use. Now, of course, we don't believe the jury should have ever reached this question because it's our contention that there's no evidence in the record that Crosstex negligently created a nuisance. And ordinarily, I would address the liability issue first, but since I'm kind of on the subject of damages, if the court has no objection, I'll go ahead and address that issue. As the court knows, to rebut the longstanding legal presumption that a property's highest and best use for valuation purposes is its existing use, the landowner has to prove three things. One is that the property or the other use of the property is adaptable to the other use. The second thing is that the other use is reasonably probable within the immediate future or reasonable time. And third, that the market value of the property will be enhanced by this other use. This has been settled law in the state since at least the 1950s when the Supreme Court handed down the City of Austin versus Canizo opinion. The problem we believe the Gardners have here is that while they may have produced evidence that the property is adaptable to residential use, which satisfies the first prong of the highest and best use test, there's no evidence to establish the second prong of the test, which is that the residential development of the property was reasonably probable within the immediate future or reasonable time. And this is not the first time the court has addressed facts such that we have here. The circumstances in this case are virtually identical to those that Justice Garner and Justice Walker faced in the Cobble versus City of Mansfield case. Like this case, Cobble turned on the sufficiency of the evidence to support an appraiser's opinion that the highest and best use of undeveloped property was residential. And also like this case, there was no evidence in Cobble that the landowner had taken any steps whatsoever to prepare the property for residential development in the immediate future or within a reasonable time. There'd been no development plans made, no platting, no effort to extend utilities to the property, no showing that the necessary zoning for it to be residential property would be enacted. And based on those facts, as Justice Garner, you and Justice Walker know, the court held that the appraiser's market value opinion was speculation and conjecture and thus constituted no evidence. And we submit that the same result is compelled by Cobble here. If the court decides to remain faithful to Cobble, which we believe it should because we believe it's good law, and the analysis that the court used in Cobble to the record in that case, the judgment in this case should be reversed and rendered. But, Your Honors, even if you disagree that Cobble compels a different result or does not compel the result that we believe it does, there's a separate and independent basis for reversing and rendering judgment here, and that is there's no evidence of negligent nuisance. The Gardner's negligent nuisance theory is identified at the top of page 20 of their brief. And it's simply this. Crosstex breached a duty to the Gardner's, quote, by placing a loud, noisy station in a quiet rural area. That's the that's their theory, and that pretty well sums up the evidence that they've submitted to support that theory. Because the station is noisy, Crosstex is guilty of negligent nuisance. That's not the law. Even viewing the evidence in this case in the most favorable light to the Gardners, their claim actually amounts to nothing more than a thinly disguised nuisance per se claim, which is a theory that, Texas courts have uniformly rejected under similar circumstances for decades. And particularly, the courts have rejected it when the case involves lawfully operated energy industries like Crosstex. The case that we cited in support of this proposition in our brief is Maranatha Temple. It's cited both on pages 18 and 35. And what's most important about Maranatha is the discussion it has of Texas law which includes a number of Texas Supreme Court cases, and its conclusion that when you're dealing with energy-related industries like Crosstex, nuisance per se does not lie. For that reason alone, we believe this theory does not support and cannot support the judgment in this case as a matter of law. But even if the court disagrees and chooses to interpret this claim as a nuisance in fact claim, there's no evidence to support it. As the court knows, to prove that Crosstex was negligent in constructing and operating the compressor station, it's axiomatic that the gardeners were required to submit evidence that a reasonably prudent party in the business in which Crosstex was engaged would have done something more than what Crosstex did, and its failure to do that resulted in injury. The gardener's bald conclusion that more should have been done to abate the noise from the station, because any good neighbor would have done more to abate the noise, is not enough under black letter negligence law. There's a case.
Let me ask you,
yes, sir.
Mr. Casey, where in the pattern jury charge would I turn to ascertain that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that there is a particular charge or instruction or question in the pattern jury charge that particularly applies to energy-related negligent nuisance cases. So what we're dealing with here is just the ordinary care instruction that was given to the jury. And we don't have any complaint about that instruction at all.
So if I'm looking at, let's just say, 12-2B private nuisance dash negligent conduct, would that be where the trial judge would go to ascertain what question to ask and therefore what proof would be needed?
Under the same or similar circumstances, I have to look at the business the Crosstex was in and what it was building.
Right.
I mean, that's your argument?
Yeah.
Even though it's of a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances.
Right, exactly. And let me just, if I may, I want to give the court the cite to this Supreme Court decision that, and I apologize, this was not cited in our briefs. My partner found it last night, and so you know how that goes sometimes. But it was not cited, but it basically just states the black letter law that we say applies here. And if I could just read you a quote from it. As generally defined by our courts, the term negligence means the doing of which a person of ordinary prudence would not have done under the same or similar circumstances, or the failure to do that which a person of ordinary prudence would have done under the same or similar circumstances. The question of the existence of negligence and its degree generally depend on the facts of each case, and if it consists of an omission to perform a duty devolved upon the person charged with negligence, which is the allegation here, it must be considered with reference to the character of the business in which the person is engaged. And that's what we contend is missing in the evidence in this case. There is no testimony other than the testimony that the Crosstex employees supplied that Crosstex did anything that it should not have done or failed to do anything that anyone in this business would have done. In fact, the only testimony that is in this record is, as I mentioned, from someone familiar with the character of the business that Crosstex is engaged in as a gas pipeline operator, is the testimony of its two employees, Mr. Mueller and Mr. Eiler, I believe, that everything Crosstex did was reasonable and appropriate under the circumstances, and that testimony summarized on pages 15 and 16 of our opening brief. Let me just, I realize I just have a couple of minutes. Let me just add this. We've briefed it. I just want to make sure I don't overlook it. But even by chance, if there was some lay testimony that the court finds that's more than a scintilla of evidence of negligence, We contend that the question number two could not be sustained on the basis of that because there's no expert testimony of any of the technical aspects of designing, building, constructing, abating the noise from a compressor station that the gardeners offered. We've listed the types of matters that an expert, we believe, would have been called upon to testify if they had called an expert to testify. We've listed those matters in footnote 4 of our reply brief. I just want to remind the court that the nuisance claim that the gardeners alleged here was based on the theory that Crosstech's nuisance them by installing a compressor station and operating and constructing that compressor station in a quiet rural area. Both of the gardeners at trial candidly admitted that they were not experts qualified to say what Crosstech's should or should not have done to abate the noise, yet they did not offer any expert testimony to that effect. My time's up, but thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Johnson?
May it please the court, opposing counsel. The jury correctly determined that Crosstech's put a noisy compressor station in a rural area and thereby negligently caused a nuisance. The jury also correctly found that the gardeners were injured by an amount of $2 million due to the decrease in market value of their property. Crosstech's alleges that it is a common carrier pipeline company with the power of eminent domain. That is a tremendous power in this state to take property. But with that right comes a very important duty, and that duty is to compensate Texas landowners for property that is taken. Also, as a user of property, they have a duty to compensate people for what they break. And what they broke here was my client's property. Now, Crosstech cherishes its power, but doesn't want to live up to its responsibility. It caused the constant noise that goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, that sounds like a jet engine, a train engine, a tractor, or a helicopter hovering over your house, such that you have to turn up your volume inside your house even to hear the TV. They call that a trifling annoyance. It is not. In the face of such obnoxious and illegal behavior, the trial court correctly entered judgment. I will be addressing the liability issue. My partner, Art Anderson, will be addressing the damages issue in this case. What was submitted to the jury was an intentional nuisance claim and a negligent nuisance claim. There is nothing secret about a negligent nuisance claim. It requires that the plaintiff prove that the defendant owed it a duty, that the defendant breached that duty, and that there was proximate cause of damages. What was the duty? It's not some extraordinarily narrow duty. It's a duty that this court has stated is that a landowner has the duty to not injure a neighbor's property. It has a duty to not have a nuisance on its property. That is the duty. Was there evidence of a breach of that duty? Absolutely. The evidence in this case, as I have just stated, said this noise was constant, it was extreme, it caused my clients to not be able to have conversations on their property, it caused my clients to not be able to operate their cattle and livestock the way they wanted to, and they just stopped going out to their property. And that was corroborated by their experts that went out to the property and listened to it, and it was corroborated by other neighbors that went out there and listened to it.
Mr. Johnson, can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Probably not real relevant, but I'm curious to know about the horses. Where was the horse operation in relation to the pressure?
The gardeners had their own horses on their property. Separately, both my clients work for a cattle breeding and company that has a tract of property near and further away from the Crosstech's compressor station.
Okay.
Now, I guess I can't get away from ever being a trial judge. Pattern jury charge, you submitted a private nuisance intentional conduct and private nuisance negligent conduct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. And as worded here, as worded in the
substantially
pattern jury
similar.
Charge.
Now, this pattern jury charge wasn't in effect at the time of trial.
I understand.
We took our best guess, and we did pretty darn good.
Okay.
It matches it pretty close.
Okay.
Now, under Texas law, there is no expert testimony required to establish the elements of a nuisance. And that comes from Barrett versus Atlantic Richfield Company, 95 F3rd 375 at 383, a Fifth Circuit case. Any competent and relevant evidence is admissible to prove a nuisance. That comes from this court in Soap Corp of America versus Bayless, 223 Southwest 2nd 957. This court has never held, no court has ever held, that there is expert testimony that is required to create the standard of care of a private landowner. It's not as if energy companies have some special standard of care. They are a landowner like anyone else. If I went out to this 20-acre tract and started a jet engine repair place, I would have the same duty that they had. And you don't need expert testimony to come in and testify as to what the standard of care of a jet engine repair place is on creating a really loud noise. And also, as this court has noted, that's not what is in the charge that was submitted. Under the case of Sicko North America versus Willis, 2009, Texap Lexus 7238, this court's supposed to judge the evidence compared to the charge as submitted. They did not have any objection to the instruction, ordinary prudent person standard that was in the charge, and that's what this court should compare it to. What is the evidence in this case that they were negligent? Under that broad standard of you shouldn't have hurt someone else's property. First, Crosstex lied about the use of its property. It placed a loud compressor station in an otherwise rural, pristine area. And it placed its station next to a large tract that it had actual notice was going to be developed for residential purposes. An ordinarily prudent landowner would not have done that, and the jury was correct in finding so.
Now, let me just briefly ask you a question about that. From the record, I was able to find in the citation that you gave me in the record was, now, did you tell Mr. Fisher of your plans to hopefully one day sell the property to a developer? Yes, sir. Now, that's it, correct? I mean, that's the sum total of I want to sell this property and have it developed into residential.
To develop for residential purposes?
Yes.
There's that, and there's also an exhibit, and I forgot the exhibit name. Plaintiff Exhibit 8. That's notes from their own employee. It states in 2005, he talked to my client, in 2005, 3 years before this compressor station was built, that they had told them of our development plans.
Okay.
Because of that, they moved the pipeline. Because okay. Before the compressor station was in, there was a pipeline. They moved it to accommodate our development plans. Okay. But even under their rubric of we have to prove a standard of care, there's evidence to meet that. And evidence that they've completely ignored in their reply brief. Evidence that they knew the station would be loud. They had complaints on stations before. Evidence that there was no line item in their budget for sound mitigation. Evidence that they didn't use a sound consultant like they did in other projects. Evidence that their own representative said it was very loud, that the sound was bad, that it was louder than what it should have been, but their employee said. A different employee stated that that their station needed to be enclosed. Their expert stated that it could have been enclosed, stated that enclosure would have made it quiet, stated that other companies have enclosed compressor stations in Texas, and stated that the cost of enclosing it wouldn't have been much different than what they actually did with their mitigation efforts that largely failed.
So could have been enclosed is basically the contention that of what they should have done.
Correct.
Right.
They had these huge, huge engines. I'm not sure the proper term. They've enclosed part of it, but these engines are outside of the enclosure. They could have enclosed the entire thing, and they didn't. And their employees said they could have, said they should have, said that it was economically feasible. So, and they don't address any of that evidence in their reply brief. So there's plenty of evidence in this record, under whatever standard the court wants to use, to affirm the negligent nuisance finding. I'd like to cede the rest of my time to my partner, Art Anderson.
Okay, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. I'm just addressing what Justice Casey started out with in terms of the undisputed facts. They really are in dispute. It's the gardeners used the property. It wasn't for an agricultural operation per se. It was really for recreational use, and they also had some cattle and some sheep. But most of the use basically was by Andrew and his family. So he'd be going out teaching his son how to ride. He'd just go out in the morning early and have a cup of coffee because he worked at the JEH station, which was right next door. He spent about 40 hours a month at least on the property every month, and then didn't spend any time at all afterwards. And if you look at the cases since like 2006 on noise, it's McAfee, which was this court, Justice Triola in the Pool River Bend case. That is the exact type of impact of noise on how people utilize land that helps to prove up a nuisance, is the fact that they used to use the land frequently, and as a result of the noise, they didn't go outside and utilize it anymore. The second one, and I think you talked about it, Justice McCoy, he said it was undisputed that there were no plans for development. Maybe it's a semantics issue. I understand there's no plat that was submitted. There was no, basically a drawing that showed that. But there was a lot of discussion, and it's in the record in the seventh volume of the reporter's record, when Andrew is basically cross-examined by Crosstech's counsel about the discussions that were held before the pipeline went in between the Crosstech's representative and Andrew. And Andrew says, I don't want that line to go right through the middle of my property because it's adversely going to affect the development. And the plaintiff's exhibit 8 I was referring to is actually the notes of Kirby Fisher, who was their representative to acquire land. And he says, well, basically Mr. Gardner doesn't want to sell us the property because of his plans for developing the track. So while there isn't a drawing, I understand that part, there was clearly a desire for future residential development. That was communicated across text. Crosstech acknowledged that by actually moving the pipeline closer to the street and cutting off an edge rather than going through the property.
Did I read correctly that $75,000 an acre was paid?
That's correct. And most of the time, Your Honor, in a condemnation case, what a condemnor pays for the acquisition is not admissible. In this case, I think we actually had a motion in limine that Crosstech had filed that they withdrew, and that testimony came in and was unobjected to. It was a small area. It was basically $15,000 for a portion of an acre. So if you extrapolate it out, it's $75,000 per acre. Andrew admits that's higher than market value because our testimony on market value was $35,000. But again, that's just additional indication of how valuable the property was, at least across text.
This was for the easement.
That's correct. And I don't have a map to show you, but it's at a corner clip. There's a road that goes like this. And one of the reasons this is such a good track for development is it's the only track in that area that basically has two parts of road access. Mustang Road is on the south, and I think is at 1358. I'm not sure. It's kind of hard if you don't have a big picture, but if you go from 380 up to 455, you've got basically the toll road and 377. This is the only street that goes from 380 all the way up there, continuous. It's a flat tract of land. With Scott Norris, who was a developer and buys and sells land in the area, was one of the persons who testified. He testified to the feasibility, the adaptability, all of those things that Crosstech says you need for the property. There's much evidence in the record that says that it was reasonably adaptable for residential use, as there was from Mr. Slater, who was our appraiser. I guess I don't understand the argument about Cobble, and I've read the reply brief where it says Cobble is controlling here. Cobble was, and I rely on that case because I do a fair amount of condemnation cases, and so that one really was based on the compensability issue of having to build a screening wall after the take, if that makes any sense. The issue in this case is what was the highest and best use before the nuisance? And it's the same thing as a condemnation case. What's the highest and best use immediately before the take? And that's kind of how those cases go. So there's not a dispute about that. It even says there it's undisputed residential subdivision was the highest and best use. That really wasn't the issue. That was a motion for summary judgment. And in the LaDrette case, which the court was about a year old, you know, they said that here's what Cobble means. The court held that Mansfield, the city, was entitled to a partial summary judgment, precluding the property owner from offering evidence that he would have to build a screening wall on the remainder property if he developed it as a residential subdivision, because the owner did not intend to develop a residential subdivision and had applied for a zoning change for commercial. So when we're talking about the speculative part as to what you look at in these types of valuation cases, the owner himself had said, I'm applying for a zoning change to commercial. If it's commercial, I don't have to build a screening wall. And that's what the court said in the direct. The other thing the court said, and I know I've argued regulatory takings cases before the court before, is the Court of Appeals treated that like a regulatory takings case. In other words, how is the city going to apply a regulation? It's like the Rimbert Flower Mound, Stafford Estates Flower Mound case. How are they going to apply that regulation to this exaction at the time that they would actually come in for development? Would they have to build a screening wall or not? And the court said, we don't know that, okay, because we're not that far along, and they could have granted a variance or it could have gone commercial. So I really don't think Cobble applies here. What does apply here, I think, is Button, which is another Crosstex case that this Court of Appeals heard. And I think it's important in that case, as well as the McKinney Independent School District versus Carlisle Graves. It's a Dallas Court of Appeals opinion about six years old, maybe, and it was petition denied. The facts were pretty similar. And in both those cases, there weren't any plans for development. In other words, there was no plat submitted, there was no zoning change submitted. And that's kind of what those cases are about. You don't actually have to submit, and this happens all the time, particularly when you get to rural areas where the property owner, you know, they live there, and they may have neighborhoods built around them, and they may be zoned agricultural, but the highest and best use is not agricultural. And that's what the McKinney Independent School District case had, because it was basically a built-up area around it. And they said, yes, it's reasonably probable that you'd obtain. Oh, I'm out of time. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Casey?
Mr. Casey, let me start you off with a question.
Sure.
Returning once again to the pattern jury charge, I don't see anything in here about immediacy of use, reasonable development immediately or in a reasonable amount of time, which then tells me that that issue may go to the admissibility of evidence about that, as opposed to, well, it wasn't a nuisance at all, as we find in these questions. Can you help me out there?
Well, I think Justice McCoy, you're correct that the PJC provides provides for how you submit a question on nuisance, an instruction on nuisance. Our argument on highest and best use goes to the damages finding, the reduction in value finding. And the point being that the existing use of property, there's a presumption in Texas law that the existing use of property is what you value the property on for market value purposes, unless you prove those three things that we discussed earlier, which
okay.
would be, so there's two different situations there. I'll be the last to try to tell this court how to read its own opinions. Cobble says what it says. I'll let it speak for itself. I think the distinctions that Mr. Anderson made are specious. The Button case did not turn on highest and best use evidence. The court in Button found, and it's, I believe, on page 10 of the court's opinion, where the court states that it found that both experts agreed that the highest and best use of the property was a mix of residential and commercial. And the court then stated on page 10 of its opinion, the dispute was not over whether the highest and best use of the Buttons' property was as developed property, but over how much of the Buttons' property had a highest and best use as commercial development as opposed to residential. Button's in apposite here. What the appellees are suggesting is that there's a conflict between your opinion and Cobble and the Button opinion. The Button opinion is pending rehearing en banc, I believe. So perhaps the court will have another opportunity to reexamine that. But nobody here is saying that the Cobble decision is a wrong decision. It's right on. Plaintiff Exhibit 8, Justice McCoy, you asked about that, or counsel had mentioned it in the context of whether what the evidence is on whether Crosstex knew there was a plan for residential development. Plaintiff Exhibit 8 does not include the word residential in it at all. There is no evidence that Crosstex knew that the gardeners had any plan for residential development on on any scale whatsoever, but certainly not on the scale that their expert testified. The possibility that the station could have originally been constructed with walls, nobody disputes that. The station right up here near the Oakhurst neighborhood's got walls around it. But that's not evidence alone of negligence. Essentially, what you've heard here this afternoon is the same argument Mr. Anderson made to the jury, and that is Crosstex intentionally constructed and operated a compressor station in a quiet rural area without any regard for the impact that it might have on the gardeners. That's an intentional nuisance theory. The jury rejected that theory and found, reasons we don't know, that Crosstex was negligent, which has put the gardeners in this untenable position of having to remake their case into a negligence case without any evidence whatsoever of what a reasonable, prudent party in Crosstex's shoes or in the same business that Crosstex is in would have done or done differently, and that their failure to do that caused injury. Again, what we've got here is a nuisance that they're trying to morph into negligence. There are two different concepts, and proof of one doesn't prove the other. And where is the evidence that, other than this futuristic plan that someday on retirement, we may sell this property for development. Where is the evidence that development of the property into residential use is imminent or is going to happen in a reasonable period of time? There is none. I believe the appellees have conceded that this afternoon. Your Honors, I firmly believe juries more often than not get it right, but this time they got it wrong. This case was well tried on both sides, and I give credit, a lot of credit, to Mr. Anderson for the way he tried this case. I've read the record, did an outstanding job. The jury got it wrong, and to uphold the jury's verdict on this record would result in a miscarriage. Thank you, Your Honor. We pray that the case be reversed and rendered in favor of Crosstex.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We appreciate your arguments and excellent briefs. And your case is submitted.